Thank you, Mel. And thank you very much for inviting me this evening to talk about this remarkable property. I'm assuming many of you are familiar with Labassa, but you probably aren't familiar with the fact that there were around 700 people who lived in this property, mainly from 1920, when, as Mari said, it was divided into apartments. I'm going to do a very brief overview of the evolution of the property so that you understand how all these people fit in. This is the Labassa today, a 35-room mansion, but it started off as an 8-roomed house built by Judge Richard Ainslie Billing, and then the 8-room house was built in 1863, and then in 1873, he extended it to 20 rooms. And then after he passed on, Alexander Robertson, who was a well-known and wealthy man of his day, he was a co-owner of Cobb & Co. Coaches, he extended the house to 35 rooms, and he changed the name to Ontario. It was originally called Sillyard Hill, then he called it Ontario. Then about 1904, the Watson family moved in, and they did fairly much what their predecessors had done. They made some modifications to the interior of the property, but they didn't enjoy the property for all that long because, sadly, Mr. Watson died about 1911, and it coincided with a period in Melbourne when a lot of these large mansion estates were being broken up. I'm sure if you look around Melbourne, you'll find some remnants of them. The land, the large tracts of land that were divided into residential housing. The house survived until 1920 as a private home, and then it was purchased by one of the auctioneers of the Labassa estate, Mr. Sargent. And Mr. Sargent and his wife, Lillian, came to Labassa with the direct purpose of converting it into flats. And they'd had some experience of doing this because they'd just come from Valentine Mansions, which you probably know now as the Malvern campus of Caulfield Grammar. And they'd had a flat at Valentine Mansions, so they were very familiar about how to set up flats in this sort of house. There were 10 flats brought into existence at Labassa, and some of these flats were put in rather unusual, innovative places. For example, this is the toilet for flat 10, and it's built into a window. And this was the bathroom for flat 2, it was built into the staircase. The toilet still exists, but fortunately this annex has been removed. One of the most important things Mr. Sargent did was employ Mr. and Mrs. Brealey, James and Emily Brealey. Here they are pictured with their granddaughter, Patricia. The Brealeys arrived in 1921, and they were caretakers. James used to do maintenance around the house, and Mrs. Brealey would do cleaning mainly, but she lived there a lot longer than James, who died in the 1940s. She remained at the house 43 years until 1964, and it is due to the Brealeys, largely, I think, that the house was intact for so long. So when Mrs. Brealey left, it was pretty much, you know, in reasonable condition. The interiors were very much intact. After Mr. Sargent moved on in 1923, we have a succession of owner investors. A couple of them lived at the house, but for all of them, it was an investment. It was there to make money, and some of them only stayed 1 or 2 years because it wasn't making enough money. It was very difficult to make money out of a property like this because you've got rent control in the Second World War, and then after that you've got a lot of people who protected tenants. It was never a major investment. One of the major changes that one of the owners brought to the house was the Willis Flats. Now, the Willis Flats are part of Labassa. They were built directly, as you can see, right onto the old laundry. It's like that, actually built on. And these were completed in 1936 and very much part of Labassa. I consider the Willis Flats, from a social history point of view, part of Labassa, because the people who lived in the Willis Flats often gravitated to the house. They moved from the Willis Flats into the house, and there was a communal life there with the Willis Flats. They used the communal telephone on the veranda. They were part of the social life. And then, of course, we have the National Trust buying the property in 1980, including the Willis Flats, and that was purchased at auction with the help of Alcoa Australia. A small number of tenants continued living in the property, in the house itself, for quite a few years after that, and the last tenants at Labassa left in 2005, so that's 25 years after the National Trust bought the property. So, in other words, Labassa has been flats longer than it has been a private family residence, which is not what you would think when you looked at the mansion. You think rich families lived in this house, but it's actually been flats much longer. Now, as Mari mentioned, I'm not looking at the first three families because they've been well documented. I have been looking mainly at the people who lived there from 1920 onwards, because they didn't leave records, and in many cases we don't know who they were. Some of them lived there for decades, but some of them only lived there for 3 months, 2 or 3 months. Many didn't even have a lease. They sublet a room, so they weren't on any records. And then in the 1960s and 1970s, we have squatters who are also residents. They occupy the tower. One couple built a little room into the roof cavity, and another couple set up a bedroom in the upstairs hallway, and they gave themselves privacy by putting a lace curtain around. So a remarkable number of people lived in the house, and it's not always easy to identify them. So let me take you through some of the people who lived there, just the selection. This is Dorothea and Lewis Levy. Now, Mr. Levy became a famous architect. They lived there about 1921. Mr. Levy was the architect for the Kiora Flats in St Kilda Road. I don't know if you're familiar with them. And this is Morgan, Andrew's grandmother. This is her wedding in 1924. And the Morgan family, her parents, lived there for 16 years. They were one of the longer living residents. Yes. This is Howard Brearley, who was the son of Mr. and Mrs. Brearley. This is Rosamond Elspeth Love. Now, she was... And she used it because she was a hostess in Melbourne's Depression Club. We used to have a nightclub, a Depression Club in Melbourne, where you could while your time away and shake off those Depression blues. And this is Louise Lovely. She was Australia's most successful silent screen actress. She made over 50 films in Hollywood. She wasn't known as Louise Lovely. She was at Labassa, she was known as Mrs. Nellie Cohen, except when she went out and she did charity functions, then she was Louise Lovely. This is Nance Hodgins and Gwen Westwood, friends who shared a flat while their husbands were away during the Second World War. Em and Brian Brown, very sadly, he died only 1 month before the end of the Second World War. The Applebaum family and a friend. The Applebaums were post-war Jewish migrants who'd survived the Holocaust. And then in the early 60s, we had a new wave of migrants, people from the Netherlands, Scandinavia, Eastern Europe. And these are the children of Labasa on their way to Rippenlea State School. This is Alan Braithwaite, a very mysterious man. He was sometimes known as Boris and sometimes known as Rasputin. And he lived in the cellar in 1969. And here we have the class of 1970. We've now got a predominantly young population of people, students, artists, poets, musicians. So we've had quite a few famous people live at Labasa, but fame, of course, is relative. I bet when I mentioned Louise Lovely, most people hadn't heard of her, and yet in the 1920s, she was huge. We've also had Detective Percy Lamble. He arrested Squizzy Taylor. Singer-songwriter Hans Poulsen. Painter Robert Jacks. Playwright John Romerill. And actor Lex Marinos. So how do I know how many people lived at Labasa and who they were? Well, I started with 134 names, a list. It didn't have the dates identified. It didn't say where they lived in the house. So the first task was to work out who these people were. Were they on the electoral roll? And where were they now? And that list grew fairly quickly because we had publicity in newspapers looking for people. I advertised in the Desperately Seeking column in the Sunday Herald Sun, and I put notices in the family history journals. On open days, we often have people turn up and say, oh, my father lived here, or I visited here, or whatever, and we always take a note of any information that people provide on open days. It can be a very rich resource. We've had some amazing finds come out of that. Of course, it all has to be checked, because sometimes, believe it or not, people confuse Labasa with another property, and they could be telling you this complete family story, which sounds wonderful, but it's actually another property. And of course, with all family stories, some of them have an element of truth, but there's been a lot of embellishment that's gone over the years. We've had two reunions, one in 1990 and one in 2013. The one in 1990, with hindsight, was a lost opportunity. We had many ex-residents come on the day who are now deceased. And in 1990, the National Trust was mainly interested in the fabric of the house. They bought it for the interiors, and that was what they wanted to find out from the people who came. So we asked people, what do you remember about this room? Was there wallpaper? What was the light fitting like? Whereas we could have also asked them, what do you remember about living here? What are your memories? Who were the people? So in finding out more about these people and adding to the list, I've used family history research techniques, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. But when I'm looking through digitised electoral rolls, for example, I'm usually looking for addresses because Labasa has had various versions of its address. So I'm looking for addresses and then the names attached to that address. I use the National Library of Australia website Trove, which is very popular and has all these wonderful digitised newspapers. But again, I'm looking for addresses and I'm looking for telephone numbers. I collect telephone numbers of all the residents and then look for them. And I look for the associates of known residents and where they are. I've spent quite a lot of time looking at war records, wills, divorce papers, immigration records, etc. And I'm sure, as you know, you have to be aware of the idiosyncrasies of any archive that you're looking at. They're very different. For example, with Trove, the newspaper site, the digitisation is imperfect because the condition of the original newspapers wasn't very good. It was imperfect. So it doesn't pick up all the references to Labasa. And also because of hyphenation of words. So you could end up with LAB hyphen and then there's a return in ASSA. So I have a very long list of check words. when I'm looking for any references to Labasa. And this has been really invaluable in picking up a lot of references that haven't been previously found. Photos are a wonderful resource. When people donate a photo, I often send it to other ex-residents or people who lived in the street, and I ask them if they can tell me anything about the people, the location or the date, and that way you get even more information. Looking at this photo, we can tell it was taken after 1969, for example, because the two girls are sitting on the newel posts, and that wouldn't have been possible before then because there was a newel lamp. So little details like that can be very helpful in dating photographs and working out when people lived there. Finding out which flat people lived in is also fairly critical because there are no records. The records that real estate agents kept or owners kept have long gone. And without some kind of list of who lived in which particular flat, it's very easy to miss whole families. For example, the Lacey family, we didn't know anything about them until a few months ago when a man who had lived in the house as a child had actually played with the Lacey boys, and he was able to tell us about that family, and they weren't on that list. You know, they squeezed in, you know, in about 1 or 2 years that were missing. Without a complete list, of course, there are many gaps and ghosts. We have a lot of people who are only known by a description. For example, the two ballerinas upstairs. We have the man who lived in a cupboard under the staircase. So we have lots of names and descriptions like that. We have lots of Trudies and Georges and Williams, but we don't have any surnames to attach to them. This has all come from the memories of people. Eventually we will find them, but it is problematic. But even with the flat numbers, the numbers don't always match, because what tended to happen is if you lived in one of the servant quarters flats, you know, one of the more modest flats, and you heard Mrs. Chadwick was moving out in the drawing room flat, then you moved and you took your number with you. So the numbers at Labasa are very much all over the place. You know, you've got 4, 3, 5, 6. You know, you can see the movements throughout the house. For most pre-1950s residents, I started with a very small amount of information and followed a trail. So this was about looking for love. And this is Mrs. Love. Rosamond Pridham Love. And I knew about her from the electoral roll, and one of the residents told me that Rosamond and her sister, Lorraine, lived at Labasa in the 1930s. They were sisters and they worked in sales. So after checking the electoral roll, of course I identified Rosamond and Lorraine, but nothing else, so I had to do quite a bit of intensive family research, and I found out they were mother and daughter. And then I found Mrs. Love's death notice in 1949 on Trove. On May 30th, suddenly, Rosamond Love, sister of Dorothy, Mrs. O. Hammerstein, USA. So, yes, indeed, Mrs. Love's sister had married the lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. So if you go to ancestry.com, you'll find lots of people claiming kinship to the Hammersteins, but most people don't know about her sister. So I went to the public records office and I looked up Rosamond's probate papers, and I found the names of her grandchildren. And as you also probably know, it's very hard to find people after 1980 because the electoral rolls aren't digitised beyond then, and for privacy reasons it's much more difficult to track people down. So I focused on one of the children, Clive, who seemed to have lived in Victoria until at least 1980, and then I went to Google and I assembled a gallery of photos of men who might fit the age group and his history of employment. And I did find a few that fitted the story, and they were in the white pages. It's very fortunate that people of my generation often tend to keep their landlines. Wouldn't be possible if they'd had mobiles. And so I was really on the track by then, but I had to work out which was the more likely candidate. Now, I'm quite happy to cold call people. It's not always comfortable, but I think if you're certain you've got the right person and what you want to say, and most importantly, if you've got something to offer them, it's fine, because if you can say, I've got some lovely photos of your family, I've got stories about your family I'd like to share with you, they're very happy to be part of it. There is a facility on the internet. The Electoral Commission has a website where you can check whether you're in the correct electorate. But it only works if you've got the full name and the address. So I went to this site and I entered Clive's details and it came up. So I was able to ring him, and fortunately he was very happy to hear that somebody was interested in his family. He'd known Oscar Hammerstein and Dorothy obviously very well, but he was very happy that somebody was interested in the Love family. And he was so delighted that he charged me with the responsibility of finding a home for his collection of Love Hammerstein photos, hundreds of photos. And so after I made digital copies of key photos, Clive donated his entire collection to the State Library of Victoria. There are some unusual items in the collection. There's a Spanish Civil War medal, and there's a diary that Mrs. Love's daughter, also called Rosamond, Clive's mother, kept when she went to the USA and stayed with Dorothy and Oscar in 1935. It's not overly sophisticated, but, you know, she says, had lunch with Lewis B. Mayer, met Jean Harlow, you know, it's got, you know. So here are a few gems from the Hammerstein Love Collection. This is Dorothy, around about the time she married Oscar. This is Dorothy when Dorothy and Oscar came to Australia in 1929 to meet the family for the first time. This is a wedding photo of the sister of both Dorothy and Rosamond. Her name was Doody. They had names like Doody and Dots for each other. And the little girl on the left is Susan Blanchard. She was the daughter of Dorothy, and she grew up to marry Henry Fonda and later Richard Widmark. This is Oscar Dorothy with her children. She'd had two previous marriages. The Christmas card from the Hammersteins. Yes, but it's a wonderful collection. Dorothy and Oscar on holiday. A photo that one of the Love family took of Oscar when he came to Australia in the 40s. And this is Clive's christening. Clive is the baby being christened. And Dorothy and Oscar were the godparents. And this is the wedding of Susan and Henry Fonda with Dorothy and Oscar in the front. And this is Clive's mother, and she lived at Labassa. That's the connection, Andrew. So when the project started, it was originally going to be an oral history, but it became apparent fairly quickly that that wasn't going to work because so many of the people are deceased and many of them live overseas or interstate. So as well as having interviews with many people, we've also got a collection of memoirs and emails and all sorts of information. So far we've got 50 face-to-face interviews, 10 telephone interviews, and 97 individual correspondents. Logistics isn't the only problem, of course, because there are many voices at Labasa, multiple witnesses to key events, and they're not always consistent. Government records don't always match what the family says happened. And then there's the selection of storytellers and the potential it has to distort the story. The people who come forward and who tell their stories are obviously self-selecting because they often have happy stories. It was a significant time in their life, and they're happy to share the story. Some interviewees may have underlying motives, not many, but they may want to preserve the memory of a much-loved family member and give them a kind of immortality. Then there are people who have unhappy memories. They may have been happy at Labasa, they've been married, and then there's been a divorce and a remarriage. They often don't want to come back and talk about their time at Labasa. And then very basically there are some people who feel they've got nothing to say because they can't remember names. I can't remember the names of a lot of the people I lived with in a house when I was at university. And perhaps they were working long hours, and so when they came back to Labasa, they didn't meet any of the other residents. Of course, some of the character of the stories can be complicating. If people have a happy memory and they have a story to tell, they've often had a lot of practice at telling it. They've told it to the family many times, so the detail gets left out. It's receded into the background, and then you've got this story that's got a beginning, middle, and end, or punchline. It's a perfectly formed anecdote. Some of the residents who have returned to the house find it difficult to recall what happened because the house has changed. So they've come to tell the story about the 1950s, but a lot of the partitions are gone, and it's not as easy to navigate the house when it's changed. Then there's another concern that has to be dealt with, and that's that Labasa itself has its own narrative and it has a kind of collective memory of its own. And this narrative has, I think, evolved out of the need to save the precious interiors of the house. And it goes something like this. This is a fine example of marvellous Melbourne, but it was allowed to deteriorate through neglect and vandalism. It faced demolition, but was saved by the National Trust. And, of course, there are very important elements of truth in this, but it does tend to influence what people decide to tell you or share. For example, some tenants will emphasise how much the tenants did to save the house and how they protected it, whereas the descendants of some of the owners will tell tales about how the residents were thieves and vandals. And there are probably elements of truth in both sides of that story. Now, one of the consequences of this kind of narrative can be seen with Wolf and Hinda Kayser. Now, the Kayser's were the last owners of Labasa. They bought the property in 1950. Wolf died in 1962. But Hinda held on to the property until 1980. And the Kayser's have been maligned for putting the house at risk of demolition. The truth is there was never a demolition order on the house. When Wolf died, Hinda refused to sell it for sentimental reasons. It had belonged to her beloved husband and she just didn't want to part with it. She couldn't afford to keep up the maintenance of the house. But she kept it. So when she died in 1980, the house had been on the Victorian Heritage Register for 6 years. And the National Trust, Caulfield Council and the family beneficiaries of her will were all actively working to save the house. So how do you bring together all these different layers of meaning and narrative? For one thing, I keep unedited records of everything. Emails, interviews, photos, I keep them in their raw condition so that if I rewrite something, there is an opportunity for a researcher to go back in 10, 50 years and totally ignore what I've done and look at the original material. And I also ask myself, by following one line of inquiry, am I overlooking another of equal importance? I try not to anticipate what people in 100 years' time will be interested in. For example, we have a lot of stories and photos about cats, and I have no interest in writing about the cats who lived at Labasa, but it may be a very important story in 100 years' time, and there may be some meaning in there that reflects on the house, which I can't see. Every family, every individual has a digital file in which I keep all these documents. But you still have to find a way of making it possible to present them to living people, descendants, and the community now. And one tool we've found is Labasa Lives. It's a newsletter which is produced 3 times a year, 8 pages, sometimes more. There are copies of all of them on the National Trust website, and it's emailed to ex-residents and people interested in the project. Initially, it was designed to promote the project and also to give confidence to the people who were contributing that something would happen to their stories, because often people go around and ask lots of questions and nothing happens. And also to know that their stories were going to be respected. You know, you hand over your life, your photos and your family stories, and then what does somebody do with it? Since then, the newsletter has become a kind of way of finding a form of truth in putting it all together, in putting the stories together. Ideally, the first thing we want people to do is to come to the house and to do a walkthrough and talk about the people they knew, their experience of the various spaces, and this is all recorded. Then we sit down and we do an interview face-to-face with a set of questions that everybody answers. For those people who don't visit, they will sometimes write their own story for the newsletter, and but more often I will do a draft and then send it to them. Everything goes back to the contributor for comment, for reflection, for review. I also try to verify dates and events, of course, with contemporaries, and all these all these communications are kept. This is an example of how one story was put together. It was quite complex. It's the story of the Jewish families who lived at Labasa in the 1950s. There were 5 families who lived there in the 1950s. They were all survivors of the Holocaust. And most of my interviewees were children, because this is so long ago. And children are a great resource, really, because they tend to get invited into other people's homes to play with children. And they may not know everything that's going on in the house, but they certainly know who's who, and they get insights into the house that their parents don't. I also had, fortunately, Mrs. Helen Applebaum, and here she is with her daughter Rachel and son Nanis. Now, she's got an amazing memory. She could tell you what laundry day was like and how you had to take your turn using the laundry line, and if you missed your day, bad luck. In putting these stories together, for each family, I did a draft. It went back to the families individually, and there was some negotiation with them if there was a disagreement over memory. And then all the families got to see the other families' stories. And again, if they had any reflections or any further information, that was put into the drafting process. I'm very lucky to have an informal reference group. I think you call them memory groups. Memory what? Memory bank, yes. Mrs. Applebaum is a member of my memory bank. And this is really important when you don't know who people are. This is George Strickland. Didn't know much about him until 6 months ago, but after I tracked down one of his grandchildren and had a photo, I was able to send it to people who lived there at the same time he did. This is George on his wedding day, his second marriage, next to his bride, Mari. They arrived at Labassa in May 1959, just a few days after this photo was taken. Now, after I showed it to a few people, they came back with all these wonderful stories about him. Two of the people who gave those stories hadn't even mentioned him. They walked past his flat and couldn't remember who lived there. But once they had the photo, they could tell you what his hobbies were, the sense of humour he had. He was a bit of a rev head. And this was only possible because of a photo and being able to circulate it amongst the memory bank. Obviously, we've got a public house, but it has many private lives. So what happens when you know more about a family member than the family knows? Do you share? There are often different versions passed down through the house, through the families, and this is particularly the case with divorce. There were a significant number of women in the 1930s and 40s who were divorced, and obviously that goes to the nature of the house. It was obviously a private, safe and supportive environment for those women. But you might find, for example, in a family that the story handed down was that grandma got fed up with grandpa because he kept flirting with the ladies. But when you look at the record, the story is a bit more than that. It's a story about trauma and family violence. Now, in that case, I might ask the family what they know about the events without telling them what I know. And then I'll indicate that the file is actually very detailed. There's a lot of information there. If they would like, I will get them a copy, or I'll tell them how to go and look at it in the public records office if they want to look at the complete file. But what do you do when a resident shares confidences about other residents? This is a lot more difficult because without the confidences of other people, you don't really get a grasp of what went on in the house. You get a very superficial view without people telling you the realities. When people do their interview, they can nominate sections of the interview not to be made public. And when people write their memoirs, they might say, please don't publish this section or my comments about a certain event. But nevertheless, there is a responsibility to think about the impact the information might have on other people's lives, because some people will give you the same story and you know, they'll say, I don't care whether you use it or not. But you have to think about the impact it will have on the families. We have a couple of very dark characters, people who have serious criminal involvement with drugs, and they now have families. Those people are deceased, but they have families. You have to think about the impact it will have on those families and, you know, what kind of public scrutiny it might bring. There are memoirs, written memoirs, that people have given us that are highly informative, very entertaining, but certainly libelous. And, you know, they couldn't be published in the form that they've been presented. So just finishing up, the process, as you can see, is very interactive. And because of this process, I think it's produced insights that wouldn't have been possible 3 years ago. I think I've got a reasonable grasp on some events in the house, and that wouldn't have been possible without people sharing, you know, information. There's no end date to the project. It has the capacity to go beyond my involvement and my lifetime. But we have priorities and deadlines. The main priority is to get to as many living people as possible and record their memories and copy their documents before they go missing. There will be a social history day at Labassa on Sunday the 8th of November, and hopefully more people will come forward. And if you have been to Labasa before, it's an opportunity to learn more about these people and also to see more of the house than you will have seen on a public open day, because we're opening up the areas where the flats were. Some of the flats have been closed to the public. Next year there will be a dedicated Labasa Lives website, and that will hopefully draw in more people, particularly from overseas. And a book, obviously, in the longer term, perhaps within the next 2 years. I'm happy to take questions, but first I'd like to just show you a few of the photos that are part of a photo essay that will be shown on the 8th of November. The photos are the work of John Harland, who lived at Labasa in the 1970s, and he seemed to have a camera hanging around him non-stop, because there are more than 350 photos in the collection that survived. And they show wonderful portraits of the people who lived there. That's John's daughter, Ruth. You can tell it's taken in the 70s, can't you? And this is Labasa's art group. They did their own still life drawing. Ian Hance, landscape artist. And this is John himself. Thank you. You might have to remind me of some of those questions. Oscar Hammerstein and Dorothy used to visit a property in Elmer Road, very close to Labasa. So they visited Australia many times, and there are photos of the whole family at this property called Sandhurst. It's still there. So maybe they gave Rosamond a lift home once or twice. We will possibly never know. But apart from Labasa, I'm just very happy that that collection was saved, and it's with the State Library of Victoria. Now, one of the questions... Andrew's existence at Labasa? Yeah, Andrew, yes, I know Andrew. I've met Andrew. Yes, Judith lived in... It was the dining room. Yeah, not the ballroom, but a very grand room nonetheless. And Judith moved there in the 1960s, and then Andrew came along a little bit later after a few other boyfriends, which he's told us about, so there's no big secret. And what was the question about the cat, sorry? Yes, I keep a record of everything. I've got photos of it. I've got a photo that I'll show on the 8th of November of Lex Marinos, the actor, with his cats.
Anybody else have a question? I was wondering, if I may. There seems to be two quite coherent groups, the emigres and the Holocaust survivors, would have, I expect, been quite coherent, and the
It was most unified when Mrs. Brearley was there. She kept the house together. She looked after everyone. And she probably had a big influence on who actually lived there, because there are occasions when there are ads for the flat and it has the Labasa number. So she would have been screening people. And she would tell people off for doing naughty things, not just the children for running on the stairs. She would she'd come into a room and she'd see the electric heater was on, and she'd sort of frown, because in some of the flats the electricity was included. So she had a fairly tight handle, in a very warm way. She had a tight handle on the house. And it was a very cohesive group at that time, but it might have been the era, particularly around the wartime era, when Labasa had its own comfort fund, Red Cross Comfort Fund. And they used to have meetings there of the Red Cross and fundraisers. Labasa had a big fete in its grounds in the late 30s to raise money for the cause, and that attracted people from right around the area.
Vicky, what drew your attention to Labasa, and is there another house or structure or place like Queen's Best Row in East Melbourne or something? Is there another place in Melbourne that is anywhere like Labasa?
Well, answering that question first, I'm not sure there is anything quite like Labasa left. There would have been other houses like it, like Sherwood House down in St Kilda. It was a very similar mansion that was converted into apartments, and it's still there, but I think its interiors are all gone. I don't think there is another house quite like Labasa that I'm aware of. I anticipated the question about getting interested in Labasa, obviously. And I did give one answer in the brochure. And then I thought about it last night and I thought, well, actually, there's something else there too. Initially, I was attracted to it because it was on the way home from work. And so I'd see the tower and I became curious. And so I'd drive around several times on the way home and I'd have a look at the house. This was in the 1970s. And I saw Hare Krishna sitting on the veranda. And it was just very intriguing. You know, it was a very interesting house. But then when I thought about it last night, I remembered that I had my own Labasa in my childhood. And I wondered about that because when I was about 11, my father bought a 19th century house in Essendon, Buckley Street, Essendon. It was in absolutely original condition. There were two elderly sisters living there, spinsters, and their father had built the house. It had all the original gas light fittings. It had stained glass windows, original wallpaper. It hadn't been touched in 80 years. And my father pulled everything out and painted all the walls white and turned it into four flats. So I just wonder if there was... I was thinking last night, I just wonder if there's something, you know, there about that. Hmm. Oh, no, it's not there. The house was sadly pulled down and it's got a block of flats. I think it was 250 or something like that. No, it's long gone, sorry.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Okay, sorry.
Isn't that wonderful? Thank you. If you had your brothers, your father Christmas was bringing you your wish, Vicky. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So human. A book seems...
Yeah.
Just keeps moving before your eyes all the time. There's different eras and people.
Well, I don't know how many people have been to a house just outside Paris called Vaux-le-Vicomte. It was the predecessor to Versailles. It was the house that Versailles was modelled on. And it's privately owned. And you can do a tour of the house. They have wonderful tours of the house. But one of the things that you can do when you walk into the kitchen, you look through an alcove like that and you can see an 18th century party going on, and it's all done by projection. So maybe my fantasy experience for Labasa is to be able to walk into a room and see how people of particular eras lived in that room. You know?
Look, everybody, I commend you to look at Vicky's work online.